From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. As the lead singer of Blondie, Deborah Harry was the reigning punk sex queen and one of the most popular voices in rock. Now Deborah Harry has a solo career and an acting career in films like Videodrome and Hairspray and the TV series Wise Guy. We meet Deborah Harry on today's Fresh Air. Also today, conductor John McGlynn tells us about restoring an American masterpiece. McGlynn recently recorded the musical Showboat, reinstating songs that were cut from the original 1927 production. Rock historian Ed Ward tells us how an unknown R&B singer named Ray Robinson went on to become the great Ray Charles, and book critic John Leonard reviews The Remains of the Day by Japanese novelist Kazuo Ishiguro. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Former TV preacher Jim Baker was sentenced today to 45 years in jail and fined $500,000 for defrauding his followers to support his lavish lifestyle. He'll be eligible for parole in 10 years. The defrocked preacher was immediately taken into custody and will be sent to a federal prison in Alabama to await a final assignment. The House of Representatives today gave overwhelming approval to a measure that would provide $2.85 billion in disaster relief to the victims of the California earthquake and send an additional $1 billion to North and South Carolina to assist in the cleanup of Hurricane Hugo. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The vote was 321-99. The earthquake aid was attached to a stopgap spending bill that allows the federal government to continue operating until Congress can finish work on several outstanding appropriations bills. The money would be divided between the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, Small Business Administration disaster loans, emergency highway repairs, and a discretionary fund run by the president. The California delegation had hoped for even more money, but members from the hardest-hit areas said the earthquake aid was a good first step. The measure goes to the Senate tomorrow. President Bush has promised his signature. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
U.S. District Court Judge Harold Green ruled today that former National Security Advisor John Poindexter is entitled to subpoena notes and diaries from Ronald Reagan. But Green rejected a request by Poindexter to subpoena the notes of then-Vice President George Bush. The judge said Poindexter has failed to show that Bush might have authorized Poindexter's activities. Green set trial for Poindexter on January 22nd. Israeli soldiers killed two armed gunmen in South Lebanon today. Linda Gradstein has details from Jerusalem.
Early in the evening, several Israeli soldiers from the elite Golani Brigade encountered two armed gunmen in the self-declared Israeli security zone in South Lebanon and killed them both. The clash, which occurred north of the Lebanese town of Marjayoun, 7 miles from the Israeli border, was the second in 12 hours. Earlier this morning, Israeli-backed South Lebanon army troops killed two Lebanese Shiite gunmen, who Israeli military sources said were from Hezbollah, the radical party of God that is believed to be holding 18 Western hostages in Lebanon. The Israeli army confirmed this evening's clash and said the troops were on a routine operation in the security zone when they encountered the gunmen, who were equipped with automatic rifles and spare arms. It was not clear whether the two were trying to infiltrate Israel or to which group they belonged. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 3.5 points today to close at 2659.22. Declines led advances 4-3 on volume of 238 million shares. This is NPR News. The Justice Department said today it has placed new limits on prosecutors' often controversial use of racketeering laws, originally aimed at mobsters, in their fight against white-collar crime. The new limits in cases involving securities fraud will restrict the freezing of assets and cut down on racketeering charges in tax fraud cases. Under the so-called RICO statute, the government can seize assets when charges are filed, keeping them in government hands throughout the legal process. A new poll taken in the New York mayor's race indicates the Democratic contender David Dinkins has lost most of his 19-point lead over Republican opponent Rudolph Giuliani. But yet another poll contradicts how much support has shifted away from Dinkins. NPR's Jackie Leiden reports.
A New York Daily News poll printed today shows that David Dinkins has plunged to within 4 points of his opponent after a week of bad headlines about his personal finances. The poll shows that David Dinkins splits the vote with Rudolph Giuliani 45% to 41%. But the Daily News admits that the poll, which sampled 500 people this past Sunday, provides only a snapshot of public opinion. The poll is also contradicted by another one taken by the New York Observer, which still gives Dinkins a 20-point lead, but says that critical Jewish voters are becoming more undecided and may switch their allegiance to Rudolph Giuliani. Dinkins dismisses the Daily News poll by saying it was wrong before the primary and is wrong again. But most political analysts in New York agree that Dinkins has been damaged by the negative publicity and the race is much more likely to be a close contest. I'm Jackie Leiden in New York.
Brazilian government officials say President José Sarney would cooperate with his successor-elect on steps to resolve Brazil's economic crisis. Officials did not say what measures Sarney might take after consulting with his successor. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Deborah Harry, has a dual career as a singer and actress. She was the lead singer of Blondie, one of the few new wave bands from the mid-70s that ended up topping the charts. As an actress, she co-starred opposite James Woods in Videodrome. In John Waters' comedy, Hairspray, she was a mother hell-bent on preserving her daughter's position as the most popular girl in high school. And last season on the TV crime series Wise Guy, she played a washed-up singer trying for a comeback. Deborah Harry has been making something of a comeback herself. She took a 4-year hiatus from the music business that was due in part to legal problems and in part to the illness of Chris Stein, her partner professionally and personally. Stein and Harry co-founded Blondie and co-wrote most of the group's songs. Stein is well now, and he plays on Harry's new solo album, Deaf, Dumb, and Blonde. It's the second solo album Harry has done since she returned to recording in 1987. Included on the new record is a remixed version of the song Deborah Harry sang on Wise Guy. It was written by Harry and Stein, and it's called Bright Side.
Whenever I collapse, whenever I fold in your arms, that's when I know I'm holding you within my grasp. Whenever I feel
from Deborah Harry's new album, Deaf, Dumb, and Blonde. And Deborah Harry is my guest. When you started recording as Deborah Harry, when you started your solo career after recording as Blondie, did you think of yourself as having like a different persona on stage, a different personality on stage?
Well, I thought of having a broader perspective and that I would be able to do things that were, I felt a little bit limited by the being surrounded by men, and I wanted to do something that was more feminine or, you know, possibly a little bit broader range of emotion.
What was the effect?
Blondie was allowed to do.
Mm-hmm. What was the effect of you as a performer as being the woman in a band with all the musicians as men?
Well, I don't know. I sort of treated Blondie as a character, and at the time, I mean, it was sort of like this... cartoonish kind of character in a way.
Describe the character.
I can't. I don't really, it's very hard for me to be objective about it. I think that she was, I think mostly what Blondie meant to me was an attitude of being a positive female and taking an aggressive position and not singing songs about, you know, having, you know, a broken heart all the time and you know, all that stuff that was being, you know, sung at the, in those days. You know, all the girls were singing songs about, you know, how demented they were because of lost love. And I knew that I was demented, but I didn't really want to sing about it.
Are there parts of Blondie that you felt you outgrew after a while?
Yeah, of course. I think that that's why, you know, the character is no longer really relevant to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, parts of it are, and I really loved being Blondie and doing that, but I wouldn't be able to just do that and nothing else. I mean, the character would obviously have to change, as I have changed.
What parts do you think you've kept?
Well, I think that I really like the energy of Blondie, you know, the positiveness, and I like the aggressive qualities about her. And but the fact that she was like sort of a positive nature.
Mm-hmm. Now, you started off when you started performing dressing in this kind of trash chic, like outfits from the 60s, which I think you probably bought a lot at maybe at secondhand stores.
What, did you used to shop there too?
How did you know that? Was it kind of like out of necessity that you shopped that way when you started out, or was it a pure style statement?
Well, it was a style statement, and it sort of went hand in hand. I don't know which came first. It's like the chicken or the egg. I think that we wanted to wear the reverse of what was going on. We wanted to wear peg leg pants and narrow lapels, and I mean, for the guys, and I wanted to wear minis and stuff like that. Minis are easy to achieve because you just chop off the bottom of a skirt, but, you know, tapering bell bottoms into peg legs is sometimes a little bit awkward because of the way they're cut. And so, we just happened to find a store in Hoboken, New Jersey, that had brand new clothes from the 60s that were, you know, still had the tags on, and they were amazingly cheap. So everybody just ran over there and ravaged the place.
And when that kind of style no longer became anti-style but actually came back into style, did you feel you had to start dressing a different way?
Well, by then it was too late.
I mean, the image had been set?
No, I didn't feel like I had to change anything. I was really amazed because, I mean, it was popular in New York, and then we came out to play the Whiskey, I think, in 76 or 77, and when we first got there, we were all dressed like that and with our skinny stuff and our minis and our skinnies, and everybody in the audience was all, you know, sort of dressed in bell-bottoms and floral print stuff, and like by the middle of the week, we played there for, I don't know, 7 days or something. And by the middle of the week, all the kids suddenly showed up, you know, dressed in black, wearing like skinny stuff, skinny minis.
That was
real funny. I didn't expect that to happen, but it did happen.
I want to play something else from the new record. The album's called Deaf, Dumb, and Blonde. My guest is Deborah Harry. And this is a song called Get Your Way. Do you want to say anything about it before we hear it?
I think the lyric is sort of self-evident. It's a, you know, sort of a crossover kind of R&B dance funk tune. Chris wrote the music, and it's sort of dedicated to Iron Mike.
Okay, here we go.
You're gonna have your day. Get your way.
Get Your Way from Deborah Harry's new album, Deaf, Dumb, and Blonde. I know that Marilyn Monroe had an influence on you as a performer, on your image. What about as an actress? Do you think of yourself as being influenced by her at all in your acting?
Well, of course, I feel like she's such a tremendous impact on American culture, on world culture, and on film actresses in general, especially comedic actresses. I don't know if I would. At one point, I think that I probably was trying to imitate her, and I think imitation is the way that, you know, you learn, and the way that you sort of develop your own style. I think that she had an amazing influence on me, on many other people.
You know, if we're talking about icons of the 50s, I think of you as having part Kim Novak in the sense of your reserve on screen.
Uh-huh, that's true. I think that I've sort of really absorbed all that stuff, all those great pictures and all those great stylish women. I think Carol Lombard is really a wonderful influence on actors, too.
Is your bleached blonde hair a kind of lifelong homage to them?
Well, it's either that or Clairol. I think that I like the way it looks. And at one point, you know, it made me feel, I think it's an excitement, you know, there's an excitement quality to it. And I did experiment with hair color a lot in high school. That was... you know, one of my things. I really loved dyeing my hair, and I probably had it every color that you can imagine, even some that weren't listed on the charts.
You've done several movies in the past few years. We mentioned Wise Guy. You've also co-starred in Videodrome, in Union City, which was an independent film, and Hairspray. You were very funny. That's the only comedy I've seen you in. I'm sure you get a lot of roles that you turn down. What are you looking for in the roles that you accept? And what is it about the roles that you reject that you don't want?
Well, oddly enough, I never really wanted to play a singer. And when the part came up on Wise Guy to play a singer, and a singer who is sort of in a state of decrepitude, I really had sort of mixed feelings about doing that. Over the years, I got a lot of offers to do exploitation kind of films that were sort of, you know, crazy punk singer, you know, murders manager, you know, and has six or whatever, nine sex scenes and, you know, a couple of car chases kind of films, you know, and I really didn't want to do that. I really wanted to make an attempt to do parts that would make me work hard and make me have to really learn something and to be an actor, you know, to really work at what it is to do that. And that's what challenged me, and that's what interests me, and that's what interests me still.
What got you your break in acting?
I guess just the fact that I was a face, and that I was an item, you know, from the 70s. Mid-70s.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. My guest is Deborah Harry. She has a new record called Deaf, Dumb, and Blonde. Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Deborah Harry is my guest. Blondie started off as a new wave band, one of the real popular bands at CBGB's in New York, and it ended up moving all the way up the charts. Did you scorn success, or did you want it when you were first getting started with Blondie?
Well, I think that it came as a bit of a surprise. You know, we didn't expect it to mushroom the way that it did, and you know, coming from an underground perspective and not being like a sort of like this mass marketed, you know, goal-oriented kind of band, we certainly had our conflicts with that. I think that, oddly enough, you know, everyone kept saying, at every stage of the game, when we would sort of like climb up the ladder of success, I think that our contemporaries and our fans that sort of would say, oh, they're selling out again, they're selling out, they're selling out, they're selling out. And I guess we could just continue to sell out. So there you have it.
Did you feel that way personally at all?
Well, it became slightly absurd to me, you know, and I realized that there was no such thing as selling out, that it is a business. And I think that you can sell out, I guess. You can lose your integrity or your sense of ethics. But I think that musically, I have retained that. And Chris is a major factor in helping me do that.
I want to play a record that goes back to 1979. It's from your album Parallel Lines, which was on the charts for, I think, a really pretty long time. One of the songs from here was number one on the charts for a while. That was Heart of Glass. But this is I'm Gonna Get You. I really like this track a whole lot. Would you say anything about writing it? Would you tell us a little bit about writing it?
Heart of Glass.
No, I'm Gonna Get You. One way or another. I always call it I'm Gonna Get You. It's one way or another.
One way or another.
Yeah.
Well, who did it? Did Nigel write that? Was that Nigel's music? Yeah, Nigel wrote that. And I don't know, that sort of just happened. I think that was sort of like a live thing. We were preparing the record. We were in a little room in the West 20s, and we were rehearsing. And Nigel came up with this thing, and everybody started sort of jamming on it, and I think that's how the lyric came about. I just started singing it. I think it was pretty casual.
Okay, let's give it a listen. From the Blondie album of 1979, Parallel Lines, Deborah Harry is my guest. Throughout your years performing, you've had a really very sexy image. And I'm wondering if that ever worked against you within the record industry, in the sense that it's one thing to kind of be on stage and have that kind of image, but it's probably not the image that you want when you're actually dealing with corporate executives and, you know, making deals about records and rights and tours and things like that. You don't want to be seen as just as, you know, very, very sexy in that kind of negotiating position.
Hmm. Well, I think that times have changed, thank goodness. Out of necessity, I think that the corporate world has grown by leaps and bounds. I found it to be inhibitive. I think that for a long time, people would only talk to Chris, and they would ask him questions that I had the answers for, and then he would have to ask me, and then blah, 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 back and forth, which was very dull and very boring for both of us and tedious and tiring. And that certainly went on for quite a while. And I think that, you know, sort of, you know, the guys want to be with the guys, you know, that kind of stuff really, that definitely goes on. I think the girls want to be with the girls. You know, maybe someday some people get it together. I mean, some people have do business both ways and seem to enjoy it. So I guess everything is everything.
Well, how did you get out of that Within the record industry, did you change your image, or did you just try to draw the line about the difference between stage persona and who you really were?
I don't think that I did anything. I just continued to do what I do, and I think that that everything exists now. I mean, I get people talk. Sometimes guys talk to me, and they talk to my chest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they never look me in the face. So that's it. I mean, and some people really talk to me, and some people don't, you know, and that's just the way it is.
Do you think it should be possible to be able to have this really sexy stage image and yet not be treated as a sex object?
Oh, I don't know. You know, I sort of like being treated as a sex object. You know, I like being treated as an intelligent person. I like it all. You know, there's... I wouldn't really want to be treated as one thing all the time, and I think that that's part of the reason that I don't do Blondie, you know, as like one character. I don't reserve myself or, you know, do like one treatment on stage anymore, is because that, you know, I found myself being treated like that character, and that was sort of unpleasant.
Has it been hard to break back into the record industry after being gone for several years?
Yeah, it has been a little bit slow. It's been a little difficult, but that's notorious. The showbiz, you know, that's what they say, you know.
What makes it hard?
I think that it just being visible and being available to people, and that's just the nature of the business. You have to be constantly sort of working and doing things, and I don't mean, you know, constantly to the point of, you know, so you're hysterical or whatever, but I think that you have to sort of be constantly working. And then it's not only important, you know, so that people don't forget you, but it's important for you because it keeps you good at what you do.
Are you taking things at a different pace now than you were before?
Well, no, actually I'm touring and promoting this record and... keeping really busy, so I don't know if that's any different pace. No, I think that I'm in full mode here.
Okay, Deborah Harry, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
My guest has been singer and actress Deborah Harry. Her new album is called Deaf, Dumb, and Blonde. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with James Abaresque. He was the senator from South Dakota and is now the national chairman of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. He's just written an autobiography called Advice and Dissent. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Virtually every fan of the American musical is familiar with Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein's Showboat, but almost no one had heard all the music written for it until conductor John McGlynn came along. He's recorded the music from Showboat complete with songs cut before the Broadway premiere and songs written for later film versions. Coming up, McGlynn talks about restoring one of America's greatest musicals. Also, rock historian Ed Ward traces the early career of Ray Charles, and we get a view of the English class system as seen through Japanese eyes. Book critic John Leonard reviews The Remains of the Day by novelist Kazuo Ishiguro. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Jim Baker, the former head of the PTL television empire, was sentenced today on his convictions for fraud and conspiracy. Ellie Boudreau of member station WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina, filed this report.
Federal Judge Robert Potter sentenced Baker to 45 years in prison and $500,000 in fines. Prior to receiving his sentence, Baker stood and said he was sorry for the people he may have hurt. I have sinned, he said, but never in my life did I intend to defraud anyone. Assistant Prosecutor Jerry Miller took issue with Baker, calling him a common criminal and the biggest con man to ever come through the door. After Potter read his sentence, lead prosecutor Deborah Smith recommended that Baker be taken into custody right away. She argued that he had already shown a willingness to evade proceedings and presented a flight risk. Potter agreed, and Baker was led from the courtroom by federal marshals. He's reported to be on his way to a federal detention facility at Talladega, Alabama. For National Public Radio, I'm Ellie Boudreau in Charlotte, North Carolina.
In Beverly Hills, California, actress Zsa Zsa Gabor has been sentenced to 3 days in jail and 120 hours of service at a shelter for homeless women for striking a police officer. She could have been sentenced to 18 months in jail. If the actress does not comply with terms of her sentencing, she could still be jailed for up to 18 months. Israeli Foreign Minister Moshe Arons has accepted in principle a U.S. proposal for Israeli-Palestinian talks, but attached two provisos in a letter to Secretary of State James Baker. Barry Schweid has more.
The Israeli reservations are exclusion of the PLO from the talks and limiting the agenda to the election Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir proposes to hold on the West Bank and in Gaza. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler called the letter a signal, confirmation that Israel is serious about moving forward. Baker has already assured Israel it would have to be satisfied with the composition of the Palestinian delegation. And Baker has said he is not trying to force Israel into negotiations with the PLO. The question now is whether those assurances will be made even tighter to win the Israeli government's approval. State Department officials aren't saying, though spokeswoman Tutwiler called Baker realistic and not an unreasonable person. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
Once again, pro-Iranian kidnappers holding at least two American hostages have offered to trade them for some 15 Shiite Muslims jailed in Kuwait. A statement was delivered to news organizations in Beirut today, along with a picture of Terry Anderson, who was kidnapped in March of 1985. In the picture, Anderson appeared to be in good health. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 3.5 points to close at 2,659.22. There was very heavy trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. In music, as in most areas of our culture, success breeds imitation. In the post-war era, many young black singers tried to emulate the success of black vocalists like Nat King Cole and Louis Jordan. For the most part, the results sounded pretty generic. But rock and roll historian Ed Ward says one record producer spotted a great talent among the imitators.
In 1935, a terrible 1-2 punch of tragedy hit Aretha Robinson, a young black woman who lived in Greensville, Florida. She had two sons, Ray, who was 5, and George, a year younger, and her husband was an itinerant railroad worker, so she had to raise them by herself. Fortunately, both kids were extraordinarily smart, especially George, who was a self-taught mathematical whiz. But one afternoon, George decided to go for a swim in a tub Aretha kept for rinsing the laundry she took in, and although he'd swum in it many times before, this time he drowned. Before the small family could recover from the shock, Ray discovered that a thick substance was coating his eyes, and a local doctor confirmed their worst fears. He was going blind. 2 years later, he was blind. He would have to attend a school for blind black children, and Aretha knew what that meant. He would be taught to beg or to make brooms. But Ray had an ace in the hole. He'd started playing the piano at the corner store. Before he left for school, she counseled him to stay away from the guitar they might try to teach him and concentrate on the piano. He followed her advice, and it's a good thing he did.
A sentimental blues will worry you and make you do things that you wouldn't do only when you hear these blues. A sentimental blues.
He was an excellent piano player, and his singing voice wasn't bad either. A young record distributor, Henry Stone, heard him singing in a nightclub one evening and brought him to the attention of a man named Jack Lauderdale, who owned Swing Time, a record label that specialized in sophisticated blues singers. Lauderdale liked what he heard and took Ray and his band, the Maxim Trio, into the studio to cut a bunch of records, including this one. Songs like Rockin' Chair Blues were all very nice, and in the backwoods honky-tonks that the Maxim Trio played, they must have been the height of sophistication. But Lauderdale saw right off that there were problems. One was that the band wasn't good enough for the piano player, and the other was that the piano player sounded just like Charles Brown, who, along with Nat King Cole, was the hottest black singer of the day. Oh, and his name, Ray Robinson, was getting him confused with the boxer who was getting so much publicity, Sugar Ray Robinson. His middle name would have to do for a last name, at least on stage, so Lauderdale's new star put out his next batch of records under his new name, Ray Charles.
Now don't put all your dreams in one basket. Don't put all your hope in one heart. Why, if you discover that she loves another, you'll be licked before you start.
And another thing, the kid thought he was good on these syrupy ballads, but he was sure no Nat Cole. The trouble was, funkier material didn't sell, except in the South, and Swing Time was looking for a national share of the growing black record market. The only people who liked the down-home stuff in the North were jazz buffs, record collectors like the two sons of the Turkish ambassador to the U.S., Ahmet and Neşvi Ertegün. They had a little record label of their own, Atlantic. Ahmet, in particular, seemed to be everywhere, and he'd heard of Ray Charles.
Down in St. Pete, Florida, how about my baby? Ever loved me like my baby, any place, anywhere.
Songs like St. Pete, Florida, recorded live at a party, showed that Ray Charles had another voice, one Ahmet was itching to combine with an up-to-date jazz backup. But was Lauderdale going to let loose of his only star? The answer was yes. Lauderdale was almost broke, and he sold Ray's contract for $2,500.
The midnight hour have found me lonely, so unhappy as I can be.
At first, Ray insisted on singing in his old style, but they kept after him, and early in 1953, they made the breakthrough that launched a poor blind piano player from Florida and America's top rhythm and blues label simultaneously. Both Ray Charles and Atlantic Records had found their direction.
You can talk about the pit, barbecue. The band was jumping, the people too. Mess around. They're doing the mess around. They're doing the mess around. Everybody doing the mess around. Everybody was juiced, you can bet your soul. They did the boogie woogie with a sturdy roll. They mess around. They're doing the mess around.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. This Friday on public television, Great Performances presents the classic Jerome Kern Oscar Hammerstein musical Showboat. The 3-hour performance was staged for television at the Paper Mill Playhouse in New Jersey. It combines various versions of the musical that have been produced since it first opened on Broadway in 1927. Some PBS stations will also air this week a companion program called The Showboat Story. That's about the making of a landmark recording of Showboat, directed and conducted by John McGlynn. McGlynn restored the complete score, including songs, dialogue, and underscoring that were cut before the opening. He also includes songs that were added later for film and stage versions. I asked John McGlynn why Showboat was such an important musical.
Everybody thinks of Oklahoma as the great watershed musical, the piece that, you know, finally integrated book and lyrics and music and dance and all of this. And in point of fact, many people, including myself, feel that Showboat in 1927 was the work that really did that. Showboat addressed issues which, for the time, were absolutely unheard of in the musical theater. You simply did not address issues of racial hatred, racial intermarriage, alcoholism, desertion by a husband. Things like that were just not part of what people went to the theater to see when they went to see a Florenz Ziegfeld musical.
How would you describe your overall vision in recording the complete Showboat?
It had always bothered me, both as an artist and as a fan, that Showboat had come to be known as the sort of light, frothy operetta. And I had always suspected that there were much deeper elements to it. And the more I studied the piece and the more I was able to get back to the original material and I saw what the full original scope of their conception was, I mean, I realized that this was really something extraordinarily dark and brooding and out of the ordinary. And in the recording, I felt it was absolutely imperative to restore all of the grit and the drama of the piece. I mean, there are several examples I can use, but the most important one, and the one that's obviously caused the most discussion, has been the restoration of the original language. I mean, the opening line of the show has always been a source of controversy. The curtain goes up on a levee in Mississippi. And it's in the 1880s, and the stage is full of these sweating black stevedores lugging cotton bales on their backs in the hot July sun. And the first words out of their mouth are, "Niggers all work on the Mississippi, niggers all work while the white men play." And Hammerstein wrote that word deliberately. It wasn't just the word that everybody used then and used thoughtlessly. He wanted to pick the word that would make this complacent society audience sit up and take notice and think about what life was like for these people 100 years ago in Mississippi.
Now, a lot of us know Old Man River opening with the lyrics, "Colored folk work on the Mississippi," or "Here we all work on the Mississippi." You restored it to the original, as you just described, but it caused quite a controversy within the cast that you were recording. A chorus of black singers who were supposed to sing it walked out. The baritone that was supposed to sing it walked out.
Yes.
Let's establish first why they wanted to walk out.
Well, what happened was it was very unfortunate that because of scheduling and rehearsals, I was not able to be present at the first chorus rehearsal. What we had planned to do was to use the chorus from the Glyndebourne production of Porgy and Bess, because I very much wanted to have a black chorus for the black music in Showboat. They got to the first rehearsal, and they opened up their vocal scores, and of course the first word they see staring them in the face was nigger. Now, they did not know the show, they didn't know the context, they didn't know what the dramatic purpose of the word was, and they just went yipes, and they said, no way, sorry, we can't do this.
Nigger's a word on the Mississippi. Nigger's a word on the white folks' name. Loading up boats with the bales of cotton. Give him no rest till the judgment day.
Nigger's still the bright blue cat from Mississippi. With a hammer on your arm. Nigger goes on a land of sand. And all of the spirit has a long and pain. Nigger's a...
There's an irony here, I think, and that is that you ended up having to use a white chorus to sing Old Man River because the black chorus didn't want to sing the original text. And this is part of your attempt to get the most authentic recording possible.
Well, not only authentic, but I would like to think the most socially conscious.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that happened like that, whether it be racial prejudice or genocide or anything, it can, if we forget about it, it can happen again. And I think it's very dangerous to try to pretend that things like this never happened.
In your recording of Showboat, you reinstated a very beautiful song, and I think this is the perfect example of the dark and brooding atmosphere that you found when you found the complete manuscript for Showboat. The song I'm thinking of is Misery's Coming Round, and this is a song that foreshadows the tragic turn of events about to happen. It's very beautiful. Why was it deleted?
First of all, at the first performance in Washington, the first preview out of town, the show ran over 4 hours, which was simply not feasible within the format and economic market of a Broadway musical. So things had to go. And anything, I mean, the first casualties, of course, were anything that was not absolutely essential to the progression of the plot. And Misery, as beautiful as it is 6 minutes of atmosphere and mood painting rather than something specific happens that moves the plot along. That's the practical aspect. The other side of it is that Florenz Ziegfeld was terrified of it. And Ziegfeld absolutely was so afraid that it was going to kill the show stone cold, smack in the middle of the first act. And I can see him, you know, at rehearsal in my mind's eye, you know, sitting there chewing on a cigar and going, it's a downer, boys, it's a downer. And but it's very interesting about Misery because its cutting is tragic because its themes are used as underscoring throughout the entire show. And you hear all these references to this dark, brooding theme without ever hearing its original statement and knowing what its context is.
Misery's coming around. Them misery's coming around. I knows it's coming around. Don't know to who. Misery's coming around. Them misery's coming around. We knows it's coming around. Don't know to who.
I think your recording is part of a trend in re-recording Broadway shows now of using opera singers to perform. And I was wondering if you think that the voices of opera singers are always appropriate.
I think most of the time they're very inappropriate.
Uh-huh.
And it really depends on the piece. Now, people have said, oh, well, you're recording Showboat and you're using opera singers. And to which my response is, no, actually, that thought never went through our heads. What we did is we recorded Showboat and cast the people who could sing it.
Do you think that your recording is an example of a trend in reevaluating the place of the musical theater in American musical life?
Boy, I sure hope so. I mean, so much of my career has been devoted to that, not just with Showboat, but with all the shows that I've worked on. When these shows were being written, nobody thought of them as great art. They were commodities. They were designed to make the authors and the producers money. And that's really all anybody thought about. Now, I'm convinced that in, late at night in the dark recesses of their studies, the composers themselves did think of it as art. They knew they were creating beautiful music. But even so, they still treated it very much as a commodity. Orchestrations were not preserved. Manuscripts were not even preserved. If a song or a complete show wasn't a big hit, nobody felt it was important to preserve it in case it were going to be reevaluated by posterity 50 years later. What was the miracle that created people like Irving Berlin and Richard Rodgers and Jerome Kern and Cole Porter and Dietz and Schwartz all at this one time, these incredible people? And artistry like that, and quite apart from the style has changed, but just that kind of artistry doesn't seem to exist en masse today. People just didn't think that it was all going to end. So I think now, people are realizing that we've lost something incredibly precious and we better find it and reclaim it and preserve it as fast as we can.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Sure.
John McGlynn directed and conducted the complete three-disc set of Showboat on the EMI label. From that album, here's Teresa Stratus singing one of the most popular songs from the musical, Bill. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. How are you? We'll be hearing today from Frank Browning about the economic impact of the earthquake in Northern California, what it's been for the San Francisco Bay Area. Also from Ted Clark with an assessment of Bush administration foreign policy so far in the administration, what critics have to say about the administration and what its defenders say in turn. Also, we'll be hearing about a new report from the federal government which shows that states that have not increased their rural interstate speed limits to 65 have fewer highway fatalities on those interstates, and why a group that's pressing for 65 mile per hour speed limits doesn't buy it.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Kazuo Ishiguro has said that he considers himself a writer of international novels, novels that contain a vision of life that is of importance to people all around the world. Ishiguro was born into a samurai family in Nagasaki, Japan, 34 years ago, but they moved to England when he was six, and he's lived there ever since. His first two novels drew critical acclaim in Britain, and now his third novel, The Remains of the Day, is attracting attention here as well. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Stevens, an aging butler, motors in 1956 through an England he's never really seen before. He remembers his great days of service to Lord Darlington. He worries about his relations with his new American employer. He meets a few radicals. He is himself mistaken for a gentleman. He comes gradually to suspect, long after the reader has done so, that he might have married but missed the signals, that his late lord, a friend of Germans in the 1930s, was a fascist sympathizer, that perhaps it's wrong to think the likes of you and I will never be in a position to comprehend the great affairs of today's world, and our best course will always be to put our trust in an employer we judge to be wise and honorable, that the butler's whole life, trying to preserve a dignity in keeping with his position, has been an indentured servitude, a horrible waste. I like The Remains of the Day, but it's been overpraised. We dust off the glowing adjectives for many reasons, none of them mean-minded. There are so many mediocre novels that a good one looks great. Isn't it extraordinary that a young man, who was born, after all, in Japan, should write a book about an English butler? Imagine the British class system as seen through Japanese eyes. Imagine a Jeeves escaped from P.G. Wodehouse into politics and sex. What does it say about the decline of empire that the best writers of the mother tongue have names like Kazuo Ishiguro, V.S. Naipaul, and Salman Rushdie? And unlike Rushdie, Ishiguro isn't showing off. He goes about his quiet business like a gentleman with an umbrella. Fair enough. I should also say that all of the remains of the day could fit neatly into a vest pocket chapter of the Satanic Verses, with room left over for half a dozen apocalyptic dreams. It's accomplished, but it's modest. I wonder, and this is a little mean-minded, if the critics like Remains so much because it's also elegiac. It seems almost to reaffirm the traditional English novel writers like Rushdie have tried to smash. It doesn't make a shake with rage. Take a look at Ishiguro's previous book, An Artist of the Floating World, available in vintage paperback. It's set in post-war Japan. An aging artist, instead of an aging butler, looks back on his life and work. Masuji Ono abandoned beauty for politics in the service of the Emperor's war party, and he is slower than the reader, once again, to realize his mistake, his shame. He seems, in fact, never to grasp the nature of his unworthy social ambitions, that hunger for status and prestige that mortgaged the future of his daughters and killed so many of his countrymen. Ishiguro writes novels the way Columbo solves mysteries, backwards, after we already know who did it and why. This has its limitations as a narrative technique. On the other hand, taken together, the two novels add up to an astonishing bicultural eye on class struggle and class war, a remarkable wisdom about servitude. If I'm impatient, it's because I feel that a writer so young ought not to be so forgiving, a writer so knowing ought not to be so equable, and a writer so accomplished ought to gamble for higher stakes, risk more of himself and his art, storm the gates instead of joining the club. Turn that umbrella into a sword.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Remains of the Day by Kazuo Ishiguro. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tuohy, Penny Hain, and Karen Impola. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, former U.S. Senator James Aberesk tells us how he ended up in Congress and why he decided to get out. Also, actor and director Kenneth Branagh tells us about his new film version of Shakespeare's Henry V. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.